Well, today is the 60th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council. So we're going to talk about the council's impact on the church today, as well as its future. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host. I'm the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. And before I get started, I just want to encourage people to smash that like button, to subscribe, but don't notify because you do have a life outside of the computer. Also, I just want to encourage people to follow Crisis Magazine on the various social media outlets. We're at Crisis Mag at most of the major ones and maybe even some of the minor ones. Okay, so let's dive right into this. So like I said, today is the anniversary. It's October 11th, 2022, which is 60 years to the day when Vatican II opened. It opened on the motherhood of the Blessed Virgin Mary, actually was the feast day back then, although they've removed that feast day as part of the reforms of Vatican II, which I guess that's a little bit ironic. Now, I think it goes without saying that Vatican II is the most influential event of the 21st century church, or the 20th century church, and going into the 21st century. It has impacted every aspect of church life. And notice I said the Vatican II event. It's an event. It really is more than a council. I think that's something that we struggle with sometimes in our debates over Vatican II is explaining what Vatican II is. Some people want to reduce it to the documents, and I understand that point of view. Some people want to reduce it just to the council itself, what was talked about. But then a lot of people want to talk about the spirit of Vatican II, the implementation of Vatican II. Ultimately, though, the practical reality of what impacted the church was the Vatican II event, meaning the discussions leading up to Vatican II, the debates at the council itself, the debates between the sessions of the councils. A lot of people don't realize that the council lasted from 1962 to 1965, but it was actually four separate sessions that ran from October to December. And during the breaks, the most of the year were breaks, there was a lot of debate and discussion as well about what they're going to talk about the next session, things like that. And so we have the event leading up to it, obviously John the 23rd's calling of it in 1959, leading up to it to 1962, the council itself, the 3+ years of the council, and then of course the implementation. I don't see how you can separate the council from its implementation. Because if you look at previous ecumenical councils, what we see is the most successful councils are the ones who had a successful implementation. Perhaps the most successful, and this is arguable, I realize, perhaps the most successful ecumenical council of the Catholic Church was the Council of Trent in the 16th century, responding to the Protestant Reformation. But that wasn't successful just because the documents were clear and were obvious of what the church teaches and said things against what the Protestants were teaching, but because it was implemented by saints. And so what we see is that a council is successful based upon implementation or is bad implementation. There are medieval councils that just simply, the Fifth Lateran Council, for example, was held in 1517. So right at the beginning of the Protestant Reformation, nobody talks about it today. Nobody cares about it today. Heck, the council fathers at Trent 40 years later didn't care about it, because ultimately they realized that the world had changed. And so when we talk about the council, we can't just say, oh, just stick to the documents. Like I have my council documents right here. I've read them many times over. I understand the argument people say, oh, I wish we just had our debates about the council surrounded or by people who read the documents. I get that. But the fact is that every single Catholic alive today has been greatly impacted by Vatican II, whether or not they've read the documents or not. And so everybody can have an opinion about Vatican II in one sense, even without reading the documents. Now, yes, I do think you should read the documents if you really want to understand it. Like I said, I've done so. I've even taken a graduate level course on Vatican II. But I do think your average Catholic in a pew who just sees what goes on in the church, he can have an opinion on Vatican II in some sense, because Vatican II is what shaped how the church is run today, how Catholics live their faith today. So it's more than just the council, it's more than just the documents, it's an entire event. Now, it also goes without saying that the council, Vatican II, has dominated church debates since it was held. I mean, this is still 60 years later, the thing we all talk about. This is still the most controversial aspect of the modern church. In fact, if you look at Pope Francis's motu proprio, from last year, the Traditionis Custodis, which sought to restrict the traditional Latin Mass, and the letter that accompanied it by the Pope, what you see is it was less about the traditional Latin Mass as it was about Vatican II. Because that's what the point of Pope Francis is, he wants to shut down the traditional Latin Mass, not necessarily have some hatred for the traditional Latin Mass, but because he believes, rightly or wrongly, that the people who attend the traditional Latin Mass are against Vatican II. They don't accept Vatican II, as he would say. And so his solution is, well, let's stop having the traditional Latin Mass. And maybe those people, when they start going to a regular Novus Ordo Mass, the liturgy of the Vatican II that came out of Vatican II, then they'll be more accepting of Vatican II. Or they'll just leave and we don't have to worry about them anyway. I don't know. So the point, though, there is that Vatican II, the debates over Vatican II have not slowed down. In fact, they've increased over the years. And the church hierarchy sees this as vitally important. I realize your average Catholic in the pew does not think about Vatican II. I get that. Not as much as I would or people watching this probably do. But I guarantee it's very much thought out in chanceries and rectories around the world. Obviously, I've already mentioned that Pope Francis, he talks about it a lot. I mean, if you look at any encyclical he writes, any document he writes, all the non-scriptural references, almost every single one comes from Vatican II or after. Very, very few come before Vatican II, other than the scriptural references. And so in the Pope's mind, Vatican II was a major turning point. And that's true for, I would argue, almost every single bishop alive today. And if you look at what they say, what they do, they talk about Vatican II themselves. They talk about in a way that Vatican II has influenced them. Even they don't realize, they talk about the faith through the lens of Vatican II. So again, it's the predominant event of the modern church. Now, there are three main sides in the debate over Vatican II in the church today. The first one would be, I call it maybe the Pope Francis side, where it's the council was great. It was a gift of the Holy Spirit. The implementation was fine. It just needs to be done more. I mean, just harder. Let's keep on implementing it like we've been implementing it and complete the implementation. And so we have the full spirit of Vatican II that will flourish in the church. That would be probably the liberal view of Vatican II. Then there's what I would call the reform of the reform camp, maybe the George Weigel view. This is the idea that the council itself was a good thing. The documents of the council are a good thing. However, the implementation went off rails. And you'll have some variances on how bad it went off the rails, depending on who you're talking to. But this is very much the conservative, so to speak, the conservative Catholic view of Vatican II. Yes, Vatican II itself was good, but the implementation took a left turn somewhere and it wasn't good. We reject the spirit of Vatican II. We want the reform of the reform. Really, John Paul II and Benedict XVI both probably, you would say they fell into this camp as well. They praised Vatican II. They thought it was great. Benedict XVI, Ratzinger, was less enthusiastic about Vatican II than John Paul II was, but he still was a reform of the reform guy who believed we just got to work harder at re-implementing. Instead of just work harder to continue the implementation, let's restart the implementation and really go back to what the council is saying. So that's the second view. The third view would probably be lumped under the traditional view, although traditional Catholics might have various attitudes towards this, but the idea that the council itself just wasn't that great. Either some would go as far as say it was just completely awful, did terrible things, and is the cause of all our problems. Or many would say the council documents themselves have ambiguities that led to lies, problems, that really the problems in the implementation are because of the council itself, because of the documents. So they would see on a whole as the council itself just wasn't a very good idea. So those are the three main camps. Now today, of course, the big proponents of pushing Vatican II would be in those first two camps. And I would argue that they both share a presupposition with each other, even though they can get into very heated arguments with each other. And that is the presupposition that Vatican II is the means to reform today. For the liberals, it's the means to continue reforming and go even deeper. And for the conservatives, it's the means for reforming if we just go back and restart our implementation based upon what the documents themselves actually say. But both are under presupposition that in 2022, the best way to reform the church, because I think everybody acknowledges that the church obviously has problems. We've lost millions of people. We lose millions every year. The church has no moral standing in the world anymore. And really, the idea of what it means to be Catholic is confused. People don't even know what that means. That's where we are today. And so the solution, according to the most Catholics, I would say vast majority of Catholics who are church leaders, so bishops, priests, lay leaders, popes, would be, okay, we need to go back to Vatican II and really use it as our springboard, our basis, our lens from which we can reform. And you see this in both liberals and conservatives. The liberals, such as Pope Francis, would say, the reason we're losing everybody is because we haven't fully implemented it. We started it, but we haven't fully done it. We got to go all the way. Whereas conservatives say, no, the implementation is so bad. We got to restart that. But again, they're both saying Vatican II is the way forward. That is the lens that we want to use. Now, I would propose another solution that gets beyond these debates. And I wrote an article about this. I linked to it in the show notes, an article about this that was published today at Crisis, where I talk about Vatican II at 60, time for retirement. And I would argue that Vatican II is simply no longer applicable to today's world. Perhaps it was applicable in the 1960s. Now, here's the thing you got to remember about Vatican II. It very much is a council of its times. And here's the thing. Most councils are like that. Like I said, the Fifth Lateran Council, the Third Lateran Council, these councils are councils of their times. And so they don't necessarily, they're not necessarily timeless, is what I'm saying. And this is particularly true when we're talking about a pastoral advice given by council. Now, every council gives pastoral advice. Many of them, most of them, though, are focused on doctrinal matters, like talking about heresy and combating it and saying what the church really believes. Vatican II didn't really do that. Now, Vatican II does have doctrine in it, but it's mostly just a restatement. The vast majority of statements of doctrine are simply restatements of what the church has always believed. Now, yes, there are a few disputed topics, I would agree, doctrinally, that we could argue about. But the purpose of the council was pastoral. I mean, Pope Paul VI said this. It was pastoral. That was the purpose. It was to engage with the modern world. I mean, that's what they talked about over and over again. Engaging with the modern world, talking about Catholicism in a way that the modern world would understand. The problem is that this council was done in the 1960s. And so it has a very 1960s flavor to it. The whole event has a very 1960s feel. And you see this, it's like, you know, people don't like the derogatory term boomer. When I talk about boomer, I'm not talking about an age. I'm really talking about somebody who sees everything through the lens of the 60s. Everything is about individual rights. It's about revolutions, about freedom. It's about all these things that the 60s were about, in the West particularly. Boomers are the ones who are obsessed with that. And they don't have to have even been alive during the 1960s. They could be younger than me and still be boomers in mentality. And really, the Vatican II is very much a boomer council. And I don't mean that even as an insult. What else could it be? It was done in the 1960s. Obviously, the council fathers were influenced by what was going on in the world around them. And so they're applying their pastoral knowledge to the situation in the 1960s. And this is what Trent did. This is what the Lateran councils did in the medieval times. You see this, that they apply to their times. In fact, if you go back and read some of the old councils, that their pastoral things are kind of funny at times. I mean, the Council of Nicaea, this one isn't really funny, but the Council of Nicaea, the first council of church in the fourth century, it said bishops should never be transferred from one see to another. Once you were a bishop named a bishop of see, you were the bishop for life. Well, we all know that's not taken in consideration anymore, that bishops are transferred all the time. That's simply because later in church life, they decided pastorally that was okay to do. But in the fourth century, they said that wasn't. Another example I mentioned in my article is the Fourth Lateran Council in the 13th century said that Jews should not hold public office. Now, obviously, that's not something a council is going to say today. And it's not something really Catholics are going to think today, most Catholics at least. But in the 13th century, in which church and state were basically one thing, when society was controlled basically by the church and everything flowed from the church, it made sense, perhaps, that Jews would not hold public office back then. Today, though, that's not something we would talk about. The Council of Vienne in the 14th century, it ordered bishops to publicly condemn any priests who engage in the butcher's trade. We can't have you priests engaging in butchery. Well, wait a minute, or butcher's trade or whatever. You can't be a butcher and a priest. Well, that's just silly. I don't even know why that was a problem back then. I don't even care. The point is, we're not going to go back to the fourth Lateran Council. Say, okay, let's make sure we follow that directly, because it doesn't apply in the 21st century. And so likewise, I would argue that Vatican II is very much a product of its age, the 1960s, and most of its pastoral advice isn't really applicable today. Now, like I mentioned in my article, some might say, well, hold on a second, it's only been 60 years. I mean, the Council of Trent was applicable for 400 years, and other councils may have lasted longer than that. But I would say our world changes a lot more rapidly today. Now, I do know that the human beings, the human heart, how we respond to God never changes. But how we reach people, how the church does her mission to the world does change over time, as I mentioned in these various pastoral advices of the previous councils. We change how we do things. The church changes how she does things. And so the world is very different than it was in the 1960s. In the 1960s, the Council Fathers had no idea what the internet is. But the internet is the dominant reality in our world today, almost worldwide. Yes, I do know there are areas of the world that aren't as dominated by the internet as we are. But the fact is, in the developed world at least, the internet dominates. And I think you'd be surprised. I know my years working in cryptocurrency, most people in like even African countries have a cell phone, a very cheap cell phone they use. And so the internet really dominates our life. Now, Vatican II didn't know anything about the internet. Yeah, they mentioned social communications and they give some very generic things about that. But they did not realize how much communities would be upended and communities would be formed on the internet. Another example I gave in the article was the suburbs. Yes, the suburbs already were growing by the time of Vatican II, but nobody knew the impact that the suburbs would have. This idea that we would drive to everything, that we wouldn't live close to our parish and walk to it. Stephen Bolivant, in his book Mass Exodus, talks about the impact of the suburbs on the church that was already beginning before Vatican II. But the Council Fathers, that was just, they really couldn't comprehend that yet. It's not their fault. How could they know that already, how much of an impact that would have? These are things that Vatican II can't address. So what I'm saying is not necessarily did Vatican II have the wrong answers. I would argue that today Vatican II asks the wrong questions. And that's a big difference. The questions we have today are not the same questions we had in the 1960s. Because of the fact that the world has changed so much. And so what I really think we need to do is we need to consider the idea of retiring Vatican II. Now, some might say that, okay, you're just rejecting Vatican II in kind of a tricky way. I am actually not rejecting Vatican II. I'm on record as saying I don't think Vatican II was like all the documents are just terrible and have no value or anything like that. I like Dei Verbum, for example. On divine revelation, there are parts of other texts that I think are useful as well. But here's an example that I've talked about a lot, and I have literally written a whole book about it, Deadly Indifference. The council has a document on ecumenism, Unitatis Regeneratio. I can never pronounce it. It's a decree on ecumenism. I've read it a lot, even though I can't pronounce the name always. I've read it a lot. And that was this idea of opening up to have a more ecumenical attitude towards our separated brothers and sisters, so Orthodox Christians, Protestant Christians. Also, another document in the council about our relationships with non-Christians. And so this became a huge deal. Now, here's the thing. At the time of Vatican II, nobody knew what ecumenism would look like. Nobody knew what the causes, what would be the impact of ecumenism. Nobody knew how to do it. This was all new to the Council Fathers. So they basically said, yeah, let's do ecumenism. Let's do interreligious dialogue. And of course, Paul VI was a huge proponent of dialogue. He thought that was the way in which the church reaches the world, which was a brand new idea in the church. But that was very much in keeping the 1960s. Again, that's a very 1960s thing, is this idea of dialogue. Let's just all get together. I mean, Age of Aquarius, stuff like that. Let's get together and talk about things. And as we dialogue, we'll come to the truth through some magical means. Now, I know I sound like I'm dismissing it, and it does sound kind of ludicrous, because it is ludicrous today. We know that. But in the 1960s, they didn't. The idea of dialogue actually sounded great compared to World War II. It sounded great compared to the Holocaust. It sounded great compared to World War I. Yeah, let's dialogue. Maybe that'll solve problems. Let's talk to our Protestant brothers and sisters. Let's talk to Muslims and Jews and things like that. Let's just dialogue. That will be our basis. We're really going to downplay evangelization. They didn't say that, but they did that. We're going to instead dialogue. Well, we now have 60 years of data on how that's worked out. And I detail this in my book, Deadly Indifference. It worked out horribly. And so I think we need to stop looking at, okay, Vatican II says we have to do ecumenism like and be enthusiastic about it, so we have to still be enthusiastic about it. No, I think what we do is we say that's true. Vatican II said that. They didn't realize what would happen when we did that. So let's relook at ecumenism 100%. Let's look at it with new eyes, not through the lens of Vatican II, but through the lens of church history, through the lens of church tradition. Let's look at ecumenism through the lens of Vatican II, but also Vatican I, Trent, the great missionaries, everything that's gone before us. How did the Catholics deal with non-Catholics in the world? How did the church deal with non-Catholics in the world before Vatican II? Let's look at that. And take all that in consideration. So we look at the past 60 years, what's happened. We looked at the 1900 years before that, what's happened. And then we come to a new conclusion, one that's not bound by Vatican II. Because here's where I think the problem is. I believe authentic reform in the church is hamstrung by Vatican II. Although Vatican II was a reform council, I would argue that Vatican II is actually hamstringing authentic reform, because we feel like we always have to go back to Vatican II and do exactly what they said. We have to do what it said about ecumenism. I think ecumenism is probably the best example I can think of, because that was a new thing at Vatican II. That was very much a 1960s thing, very much dated. But now things are different. We've seen what it does. And so if we're bound to the Vatican II way of looking at ecumenism, then I think we're hamstrung. We're not willing to look at other ways of addressing non-Catholics and maybe flavoring our ecumenism with a little more evangelization. Maybe flavoring our interreligious dialogue with a little more proclamation of the gospel. And I would argue that a lot of the Council Fathers actually would have been horrified with how things have gone, which I know is kind of a reform of the reform thing. But even reform of the reform still, though, would say we have to stick to ecumenism as the Council Fathers called for it. But I think we don't necessarily have to. After all, the church got along fine for over 1,900 years without ecumenism. So why do we have to necessarily be slaves to exactly the way Vatican II, a 1960s council, said we have to do it? So again, I'm not rejecting Vatican II and saying, okay, we just cancel it or something like that. What I'm saying is we're not hamstrung with it. We look at the totality of church tradition, the totality of how the church has operated over the years. And we basically go and we go deeper into what the church has always taught. So I don't think Vatican II, in other words, should be the lens for reform. Now, saying that is not a rejection of Vatican II. What it's saying is that it's one council. We treat it like one council. We treat it like we do Trent, like Vatican I. We treat it like we consider the five Lateran councils, like we consider the Council of Florence, like we consider the Council of Nicaea. We put it all into the whole pot of Catholic tradition. And we use that as our lens for true authentic reform. So Vatican II becomes, it gets retired as the active council, I guess is the way you could put it. It's been the council. Like in 1950, for example, the active council would probably still be Trent and Vatican II, some of course. But by 1965, the active council was Vatican II. But I would say, let's retire. We don't need a new council, by the way, to trump it or anything like that. But we simply say, okay, it's no longer the active council of which everything is seen through that lens. Now, some, I in response to my article this morning, I've already got some people say, you know, but Vatican II has some good teachings in it. I like Vatican II. I like things about Vatican II. That's fine. I'm not saying you don't have to think that. I'm not saying you can't say that it has certain good teachings. What I am saying, though, is that you can't simply look at Vatican II and say we have to accept Vatican II as the event. Because that's what Pope Francis is doing. He's saying we have to accept Vatican II, the event. Not necessarily this good teaching or that good teaching. We need to instead look beyond Vatican II and say, okay, let's build upon it all. So essentially then, just to kind of conclude here, I just want to say that I think the debates over Vatican II, which I've been part of, I will admit freely, I've been part of these debates as much as anybody, are harming the church at this point. But the solution isn't to say, okay, we're just going to do Vatican II harder. The solution is to simply say, okay, the reforms of Vatican II, some of them might have worked okay. Some of them might have not worked okay. Maybe that's the fall of the council itself. Maybe that's the fall of the implementation. Ultimately, it doesn't matter for souls. That's the thing that's frustrating about these debates in my mind, is that it's like internal, inside baseball. We're arguing over in baseball, they're arguing over the designated hitter rule, and they're having all these fights about it while fans just go watch football instead. And that's what we're doing in the Catholic Church. We're fighting over, okay, did Lumen Gentium, when it said subsisten, which I think was, you know, a bad wording, and I've debated about this. We're debating about what people are leaving for other religions and no religion. What we need instead to do is say, let's look at the world today. Let's look at the rise of the internet. Let's look at the fact that millions are leaving the church. Let's look at the fact that that the suburbs have impacted us greatly. Look, all these different things are going on today, right now. Let's look at it with a 21st century view that takes in consideration 2,000 years of Catholic teaching. Doesn't just look at one council as the active council we're still trying to implement. The implementation's over. The active idea of the council, Vatican II being the active council, that's over. Let's instead move forward and look at how we can evangelize the world today. Okay, that's it for now. Hope you enjoyed that. Until next time, everybody, God love you.